Listeners, are you still buying your coffee at the grocery store or coffee shops? Because that is FUBAR. Every coffee lover knows that the key to the best coffee is fresh roasted beans, but most coffee you buy in the grocery store or your local coffee shop was roasted months before it got to you. That's why there's Sparkplug Coffee now! Sparkplug Coffee is roasted to order in Toronto and delivered right to your door while the coffee is fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans sourced through direct and fairly traded methods. They have many blends to choose from to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. And they offer set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you never run out of fresh coffee again. You will taste the difference. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
I looked up FUBAR in the manual. What does that mean?
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey there, movie people, and our everlasting thanks for plugging in your earphones to listen to the Top 121 Project. We are on the doorstep of completing our quest to review each of the 123 movie-type films on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the rockingest American pictures. As always, we warn you that we will bomb you with spoilers. I am Private Ryan Ellis, naturally, and this is my grizzled war vet wife, Bev.
That's me.
Didn't sound too grizzled. Work on that a little bit, right? Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Saving Private Ryan. Who had more films nominated for the 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists? Tom Hanks or Steven Spielberg?
Spielberg.
Barely, though.
Barely, although it depends if you count him as a producer.
No, I meant as a director.
Oh, okay.
As an actor.
As a director, he just squeaked out one more than Tom Hanks.
What was the score then?
Hanks has 7. Toy Story, Forrest Gump, Saving Private Ryan. And then the 4 nominees that didn't make the list were Big, Philadelphia, Sleepless in Seattle, and Apollo 13.
Correct across the board.
While Spielberg got on the list for Jaws, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T., Saving Private Ryan, and Schindler's List. And he was nominated for The Color Purple and Jurassic Park.
You're right. And the reason why I asked this question is because I thought it would be a blowout. I thought Spielberg would have way more than Hanks. But Hank surprised me with Big in Philadelphia, and even Sleepless in Seattle. I didn't think those would be nominated. So there you go. These old friends and the star and director of this movie almost had the same amount of AFI films, and quite a few in total, 15 between them. Although they did overlap, obviously, with this one, which is the Top 100 Project's 121st movie, Saving Private Ryan, which didn't even exist in time for AFI's 1998 Top 100, but then made the cut at 71st in 2007, between A Clockwork Orange and another newcomer, The Shawshank Redemption. Saving Private Ryan was released by DreamWorks and Paramount on July 24th, 1998, and I was in the seats not long after that date. I saw this movie when it came in the theater. The flick was a king-size success. But if you're not familiar with that success anymore after all these years, Bev will describe it for you right now with the skinny.
Tom Hanks is John Miller, a captain with the U.S. Army in charge of a platoon of soldiers attacking the beach of Normandy on D-Day. After that horrifying experience, Miller and 7 of his men are tasked with going deep into occupied France to find the only surviving son of the Ryan family, and that's Matt Damon. Folks, war is fucking hell.
Or, in a nutshell, school teacher gets shot in the chest while traveling through France. Bang! In the chest. Okay, so the numbers on Saving Private Ryan first. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 92% of them like the movie, 120 fresh and 10 rotten. 95% of audiences. It's also 30th on the IMDb 250, another movie from the 90s that is pretty highly ranked on that list. SPR is 119th on Box Office Mojo's Adjusted for Inflation list. Pretty impressive ranking. Another Spielberg movie that's on that adjusted list. Its total is $381 million adjusted, which is just less than $1 million ahead of Young Frankenstein, also obviously a huge hit in 1974. And the movie was first at the 1998 U.S. box office, another number one hit for Spielberg in a given year. Armageddon was number 2, although I think Armageddon was number 1 worldwide. And the Oscar winner for Best Picture that year, Saving Private Ryan's competition for that award, Shakespeare in Love, was 18th. Also a success, but not obviously as big as this movie. All right, Bev, last Spielberg movie, his 6th of 6. What were your thoughts on Saving Private Me?
I think that the 24 minutes this film spends on the invasion of Normandy is a masterpiece. Probably deserves the title of greatest battle scene ever made. And I think that the rest of the film is highly adequate. There are some good scenes. There's some very jarring missteps, in my opinion. I really love that Omaha Beach scene, but I have never had that much love for the rest of this film. And I'm a little surprised how forgiving critics and fans are of its flaws.
What about the defense of the bridge at the end? Also pretty impressive.
War scene stuff. I like that scene a lot, but I think if that was the best scene in this movie, it would just be like a great also mentioned Spielberg film. It's the Omaha Beach scene at the beginning that makes it remotely close to a great film.
And in the middle of the movie, we meet some interesting actors in some different kinds of roles for them. Paul Giamatti wasn't really a name back then, but he's got a fairly major part in the movie. And then Ted Danson, who saves Paul Giamatti and our main characters in that standoff, that Quentin Tarantino-esque Mexican standoff with the Nazi soldiers that just happen to get revealed when that wall gets broken through. Danson was always known for comedy, especially on TV. And even though he's in the movie for maybe 10 minutes, I think it's pretty effective stuff. And it also gives you a reason as an audience member to think, okay, the mission they're on is fucking stupid. They also comment on that, the main characters do, through different parts of it, including when they're first going on the mission. But Danson's character gives you a little bit more credibility with it by saying, find him, get him home. But let's get into that, because sure. That's the thing I've always criticized about this movie the most, and when we watched it this time, I thought even more. The George Marshall in this movie, played by Harv Presnell, whatever his name is, the guy from Fargo, Wade Gustafson. Oh, jeez. You're not selling me a damn car here. And I'm sure this isn't based on the real guy anyway, but what a stupid mission. We're going to get him the hell out of there. You have to win the war. I'm sorry if Mrs. Ryan loses all of her sons. They all went into the service. If they die, they fucking die. Sorry, too bad. This is based on some Bixby family, then Bixby Nyland letter or something like that, which has since been debunked, which was during the time of the Civil War, and that's where he gets the Abraham Lincoln thing from.
The Abraham Lincoln letter, which the general quotes to rationalize his decision, even though Lincoln himself never made any efforts to save the brothers of this family. So you can't use Lincoln as your rationalization for this mission.
Yeah, and in that scene, I talked about Danson and Giamatti. We also get Bryan Cranston, one of the great modern actors, more so from TV like Danson is. He's the one-armed colonel. And Dale Dye, the guy who worked with Oliver Stone on Platoon, and Robert Zemeckis and friends, including, of course, Tom Hanks on Forrest Gump. He has a role in the movie itself as a reluctant colonel. This is a bad idea, General George Marshall. Dye was the military guy who took people in Platoon and Saving Private Ryan, and other movies too, of course, out in the middle of nowhere and said, this is what it's like to be a soldier for only a matter of a week or two. And the story goes on Saving Private Ryan that they took out the entire Hanks group of people, and they all wanted to quit after a couple of days. But Hanks himself, who'd worked with Dye on Forrest Gump, said, no, let's stick it out, and because he's the big star, they had no choice. The one guy who didn't go was Matt Damon, and that was supposed to be Spielberg's idea that said, you resent this guy even more because this actor didn't have to go through this with you, so we now hate this guy even more than we already do.
Yeah, the characters resent him because he wasn't in Omaha Beach like the rest of them, but the actors resent him because he didn't have to spend those 10 days at boot camp, which, if you read the descriptions, they really are terrible. They were just sleeping for several hours a night. They weren't fed enough. They were trying to sleep soaking wet in miserable cold temperatures and going on daily 6-mile hikes with heavy packs. The type of stuff that really strips down your defenses and breaks you down. The type of stuff that would make actors making millions of dollars want to pack it in and say, to hell with it, it's not worth it.
And one of the guys in that group, Vin Diesel, has become a big star in his own right. Debatably, well, okay, Hanks is the biggest name of all these people still as an actor. But Matt Damon and Vin Diesel are not that far behind him on the depth chart as far as big stars go. Vin Diesel with all those Fast and Furious movies and Matt Damon with everything, especially the Bourne series. Damon was cast by Spielberg not knowing he was going to be a big star, but they made Good Will Hunting. That came out in, I think, the late part of 97. So they're already shooting this movie, and then suddenly he blows up. He'd been in Courage Under Fire. Good role, good movie. He was in other films before that, too. He was in Rounders earlier this year, or maybe it was later this same year, 98. One of my favorites, but nobody really saw it back in 98.
He was introduced to Damon by Robin Williams, who had worked with Spielberg on Hook. And he was like, I'm working with this guy in this film, you gotta meet him. I don't know if he straight up suggested they cast him, but Spielberg recognized him from Courage Under Fire, asked him, hey, weren't you like really skinny in that movie? And he's like, yeah, I lost a lot of weight. And thought, hey, now that he's not scrawny anymore, maybe he could play this part.
He looks like a believable soldier. I read Edward Norton, who was Matt Damon's co-star in Rounders, was the first choice, but he turned it down. Could have been the title character and said, nyet.
Yeah, the character who is the MacGuffin of the movie. He is the driving force, the mysterious and is it worth it or not mission, which ultimately is the main theme of the film. Is it worth risking many to save one?
Nope.
Well, you obviously agree with the soldiers in Hanks's company.
And Hanks himself, who doesn't actually say it out loud, he does that whole thing where if he was speaking to a major, this is a great mission, sir, and I'm proud to be part of it, sir, worthy of my best efforts, sir. And then later on, he does confess. I don't know who Ryan is. I don't care. It's just a name to me. But if it gets me home, then fine.
But he kind of goes back and forth. Mm-hmm. They all go back and forth a little, which is part of what I don't love about this movie, that it seems wishy-washy about exactly what it's trying to say about it. Although, that was part of Spielberg's intention. He said that the movie's about how two opposing things can be true. The mission can be both justified and not justified, because you can look at Ryan specifically, the situation that they're in, and you can say, okay, well, that's a dumb PR mission that this general who's very far away from them, and that's cinematically told very well when you look at the conditions of the soldiers versus the conditions that the general is in his clean office with his crisp uniform and all the comfort that he wants, making this decision that is going to get most of those guys killed so he can turn around and say that he did this one good thing for this one family. But it begs the question, it forces the audience to answer the question, is a soldier's sacrifice ever worth it? Because we are all, in a way, Private Ryan. All those soldiers that died in Normandy, that died in World War II, in World War I, in Vietnam, they all died protecting the Americans back home. At the very least, believed it. The decisions were made to protect America as a whole. So we all owe them the same debt that Private Ryan owes that company. Most of them died trying to save him, specifically.
I like when they finally find him, and Damon plays it very well. I'm not leaving here. I'm going to stay here with the only brothers I have left. Tell my mother that.
He also doesn't agree with the mission. Everybody is really conflicted about it, or not that conflicted about it. They all think the mission is dumb. They all think it's a bad idea.
It's all FUBAR. What if they had just left without him? Hanks and the rest of the guys go back. They'd lost two guys at that point. Went back to his superior officer and said, we found him. He refused to come. They maybe wouldn't even believe him. Go back out there and look again. At least they'd know where to go this time. But still, they'd be kind of screwed, I suppose, if they hadn't stayed to help him. Or dragged him out by his hair and said, I don't care, punk, you're coming with me.
I mean, they're soldiers. They have orders. Presumably, Private Ryan would have orders, too.
Which was to defend that bridge, in his opinion.
Yeah.
I said I don't agree with the mission. I think a movie that gets this better, and we talked about during that podcast, one of my favorite movies of all time, Apocalypse Now, also has the soldiers criticizing the mission and the point of that movie. They're going in there to kill a colonel. They're risking the lives of five or six guys in that movie to kill one of their own people. Then again, when you watch the movie and see how it plays out, you can understand how the people back in Nha Trang would want that to happen. Although maybe you can't. But Apocalypse Now knows how fucking dumb that whole point is. There's nothing to do with Vietnam at all at that point. It's all about, gotta follow orders. If you don't, you're gonna get whacked. And we're gonna lose a lot of our guys in the process of getting to get you whacked. So we got the same kind of story here, and as much as I like Spielberg, I don't know if he's quite on the same level of Coppola of saying, this is absurd, why are we doing this? And yet, Saving Private Ryan opens with a waving American flag, and it closes with a waving American flag. At least it's shot a little differently than we usually see with the red, white, and blue thing. It's actually looking like a white flag because of the light coming through it. And Oliver Stone criticized this movie for its raw, raw stuff, much like he did Patton.
And this is kind of where I have a problem with it. It's, on one hand, clearly an anti-war film because it's portraying the real horrors of war in the most realistic,
better than it ever been done before.
Absolutely. And that scene deserves all the praise it gets. It's absolutely incredible. He went to great lengths to make it as realistic as it was. There were over 1,000 extras. They all had unique uniforms created from scratch just for this film. It cost $12 million to make. They had real amputees on that beach. They went to great pains to make sure all the details were right. He did not use storyboards because he wanted the action to dictate where he put the camera. They had these elaborate processes of bleaching the film so that it looked like a colorized version of what the newsreel footage looked like.
Very desaturated, though.
Yes, and it works. It really puts you there. It's an incredible documentary feel. The number of times the camera just looks like it's not shaking as if it's a person that can't hold the camera steady, but shaking because a bomb went off nearby, you know, and it's tremoring. I can't praise it enough. But you would think that in itself would be a scathing condemnation of war, and yet you have that terrible, sentimental hack scene at the top, starting with the American flag, starting with the stand-up salute patriotism. You're about to watch a propaganda film.
Oh, he does
shot
at the end, not the beginning.
Yeah, he does. He opens with the American flag.
But the salute, the old man salute is at the end.
Fine, but I'm just saying, figuratively, putting a flag like that, and up for long enough that you have to sit there and think about the flag. It's not just flashed there. It's left long enough for people to really take notice of it and think about what they're looking at. And that terrible scene with the older Private Ryan and,
well, to mislead, we think it's going to be Captain Miller. The way the movie presents it is that's who this is. He's thinking back to what happened. Ryan has no experiences with D-Day, at least on the beach. He was dropped in the middle of France as an airborne guy. He was parachuting in. He has no recollection whatsoever that his brother, Sean, is on the beach. We see him laying dead in the sand. So is it a cheat to mislead us like that?
It's the least of my problems with that scene, honestly. Like, yeah, it's a mislead and it's not great. Why would you even bother doing a cheap mislead? You're so worried that the audience is going to figure out that Miller is going to die at the end. You want them to be that surprised that he dies? I don't know. When you juxtapose those highly polished, over-sentimental scenes with the wartime scenes, it's a jarring change of tone, and it broadcasts just how manipulative and phony those other scenes are. And I mean, also the scenes that take place in headquarters where the general makes the decision, they blanket it with that score. This is when I don't like John Williams. Ugh, come on, it was wall-to-wall score, and it was overkill.
In that scene, some of the rare women in the entire movie, along with Mrs. Ryan. I don't think we see women anywhere else. Although we pointed out on Titanic, it's Lily White. This movie is also Lily White. But in both cases, that's period accurate. There would be nobody who wasn't white on the Titanic, or if they were, it'd be very few of them. And there'd be very few non-white soldiers, especially in the German army in World War II. So at least they're being period accurate. But Titanic has some of the same problems. The modern scenes with Bill Paxton, Gloria Stewart, and all those actors, and then the stuff with the older version of Matt Damon. And by the way, at the very end, when he says, "Tell me I'm a good man," you are. Was Ryan actually a good man, or is his wife just a liar? We don't know this, but I'm speculating.
I know that...
Did he invent a longer-lasting light bulb?
That is a good line. What could one person do to earn the sacrifice of all those men?
Your hot granddaughters.
Oh, Jesus. But in that same way, the debt that Ryan owes those men that came to save him are the debt that we all owe, and which is what Spielberg is trying to say in a clumsy, over-sentimental way.
This movie's on the Cheers list, and I remember when they showed that AFI show, number one on the Cheers list was, do you remember?
Oh, no.
It's A Wonderful Life. And Spielberg commented during It's a Wonderful Life by saying, every man's life is precious, and everyone matters, and when he wants to kill himself, that's stupid anyway, but especially over a little bit of money. And of course, the whole message of Wonderful Life is that we all matter so much, and this guy affected so many people. So even though we're saying, and I'm certainly saying, that the idea of saving Private Ryan is fucking dumb in the middle of a war to save maybe the entire planet, and certainly Europe, I can understand Spielberg's mentality more when his mindset is, but we all matter. If we save this one guy, it means the most. And Tom Sizemore even says, maybe Saving Private Ryan, that's the name of the movie, is the one great thing we get out of this shitty mess.
But then Ed Burns says, I have a mom too. Mm-hmm. We all have moms. They all have people waiting for them back home. All their lives are precious as well.
And I go back to the same thing I said a few minutes ago. If Mrs. Ryan loses all four sons, then they all shouldn't have enlisted, I guess. Sorry. That's the price of war. That's why you don't go to war as a country unless you want to go all the fucking way, and you might lose every one of your people in the process to try to win. And if you're not willing to do that, then don't go to war. And sorry to the mothers and the fathers, the sisters, the brothers, the wives, the husbands that get left back home. If that's what happens, then that's war. No different than Born on the 4th of July. A great movie. I love it an awful lot. I think Oliver Stone also gets it, maybe not quite as much as he should, which is if you come back with half a body, there's a certain part of you that has to realize, if I died over there, I was willing to give my whole body. Why is it such a horrible tragedy? And it is a tragedy, I know. But if I was willing to give all that, then if I come back a broken man, that was the price I was willing to pay.
A lot of people say World War II was the last good war. It was the last war that people could go and fight and lose their sons and feel like their sons really died for a purpose to make the world a better place, to save them from a great villain. But watching that scene in Normandy and that last battle scene at the end of the film, I think Spielberg is trying to say even the good war, even the good fight, is still a gruesome pile of senseless carnage.
Horrible pain. People screaming for their mothers more than once, including Wade when he goes, "Mama, mama, mama," and then he just expires. It's the last thing he ever says.
And there are people that didn't even make it onto the beach. How senseless is it that there's somebody who just drowned because he couldn't get his pack off on time to swim to the beach?
Or the shooting gallery guys who were shot as soon as that gate goes down. Right there. They're dead.
They knew. The generals knew they were going to take casualties like that and that they were going to lose a lot of men and that they were just basically sending them out there as cannon fodder so that the last wave or whatever could get through and accomplish something over there. This is something that they deal with in Paths of Glory, the old Kubrick war film about a company of men that simply refused to sacrifice their lives because they knew they were going on a suicide mission.
And that's a true anti-war film. I believe also there are French soldiers in that movie. You just said bloody and gory and all those things, and this movie, of course, is famous for all of that. The movie did not get an NC-17, but Spielberg would have accepted that. He did not want to take anything out, but the movie does get a very hard R for violence. That was coming on the heels a few years before of Braveheart, which shows some of the same kind of awful stuff with maces getting blasted into people's faces and, of course, swords and bows and arrows. And because they shot this movie in Ireland, which is where a lot of Braveheart was shot, I believe they used some of the same people as extras who already knew what they were doing. They had done it a few years before for Mel Gibson. The movie also was shot in England, and they did do some of it in France. It's entirely set in France. At least the characters we care about are there. And because of all those things, Spielberg didn't even expect this to succeed, let alone be a blockbuster, like he felt about Schindler's List. And we said this on Pulp Fiction. It was also true about Titanic. People who made the movie didn't know they had themselves a massive hit. Of course, he really knows that. That's the line William Goldman had. Nobody knows anything. Spielberg would have been fine with this movie just getting released, and whatever it makes is what it makes. I want to make this movie as a tribute to my father, who served in World War II. And Spielberg's movies as a kid, and then a very young adult, were war movies. He's focused on the war even indirectly many times. The entire Indiana Jones movies are about wars and one or another. Not so much the fourth one that no one likes. But Raiders and Last Crusade are literally set during World War II, and the Nazis are a factor in those movies. But getting back to the rating situation, this is one of the highest body counts on the entire Top 100 project. I guess Titanic probably has more than we see because of all the people that just die freezing to death and plummeting on the boat and all that stuff. Hey, two in a row with all these horrible things that are going on with these poor people.
I recall Gone with the Wind had some pretty gruesome scenes with the suffering soldiers.
Yeah, that famous shot where Scarlett O'Hara is standing amidst all these men who are probably going to die.
But the violence in Saving Private Ryan is incredibly visceral and authentic, so much so that veterans who saw the film, some of them started experiencing recurrences of PTSD, and they saw an increase in veterans taking advantage of services offered to soldiers suffering PTSD, so they set up a hotline for them to call if they were having trouble. There was even a recommendation put out, if you're sensitive, don't bother seeing the film at all.
When I saw this the second time with a friend, one of the few movies I've ever seen twice on the big screen, it would have been, I think, in early 99, probably for the Oscar run, around that same time. I knew it was going to happen. I saw it back in July of the previous year. I was literally, and I'm not exaggerating here, gripping my seat.
That's a good movie.
And also in that opening sequence, I don't think you see the camera go above head level. It mostly is point of view type of stuff, especially when those guys are doing that whole burrowing thing where they have to get the other side of the hole blown apart. We're in business! And they go over, and then that's when they finally get to the point where they can shoot down that nest kind of thing with Jackson blowing out the side of it. Most of the camera shots, as I recall, are at head level or even lower. Or if they're ever higher than that, it's the few times we see the German point of view shooting at them.
Because if you were making a newsreel, that is how it would look. That's where the newsreel photographers would be, on the ground with the soldiers.
It would have been an interesting shot to do it once, like they do in Wild Bunch, where the camera's up above and you see the little carnage of those bullets flying every which way, and would only have a few seconds to do that. It's effective in that movie, but that's also very stylized. If you want to go realistic, you never get that camera above shoulder height or head height, and that's why this movie won the awards it did, probably, because the whole point of directing in a movie is where do you put the camera? And the opening battle sequence is a great example of put the camera in the right place, then, and then, and then, and then, and Spielberg and Janusz Kaminski hit a home run in every one of those shots in the opening sequence, and I would say also in the closing battle sequence.
So speaking of Peckinpah, I read in one of the reviews, they said that that Normandy invasion scene made Peckinpah look like a total sissy.
I don't know if that's true, because Wild Bunch is some tough stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Saving Private Ryan definitely gives it a run for its money. It is more violent than Wild Bunch.
Oh, it's probably the most violent movie that's ever been made, at least as far as a movie that isn't going for that
torture porn.
Even those movies are so cartoonish sometimes that they don't really frighten you. They don't really seem like that really happened to that guy. The great shot in the opening of Saving Private Ryan, there's so many ones you could pick, but a lot of people have pointed this one out. The guy's walking around looking for his arm, as if he needs it later.
Yeah.
He's just cannon fodder. It's amazing that he doesn't get shot. Maybe he does later on. We don't see it happen. That's obviously the shock he's going through. What you can find online, I did not know this until my research for this viewing we had this recent time. When you see those X-like things that are stuck in the sand, those obstacles, and you also see that lumber with, I guess, a pointed kind of edge to it. It's kind of like in Braveheart. We talked about that before, where those guys have the hold, 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 and then when the horses get close enough, they pull up all the spears and the horses get impaled on them. That stuff was set up by the Germans so that when the Americans and everybody else that landed on D-Day, it wasn't just Americans, but in this movie it is just Americans, when they landed, if they were going to try to land on that beach, they would hit all those obstacles, they would ram into those hold posts, the boats would get torn up and they'd be screwed right there.
Those things that look like jacks, they all had mines in them as well, so that if a boat hit them, they would explode.
Mm-hmm. But that didn't happen because it was low tide, because they came at dawn. Much like in Apocalypse Now, when they attack during the famous Ride of the Valkyries sequence they attack at dawn. And speaking of war films, this same year Thin Red Line came out. That was about the Pacific Theater, as it was called, rather than Europe where we have this. Not an uncommon thing. A lot of times you'll have movies with the same themes coming out the same time frame, or even the exact same couple of months. Armageddon and Deep Impact came out this same year, both about comets and asteroids coming to kill us all.
There were probably two World War II films that came out this year. World War II is just a topic that filmmakers love to mine over and over and over.
Not usually from major filmmakers like Spielberg and Terrence Malick, though.
Fine, that's the coincidence part of it, but there are more World War II movies than stars in the sky.
A few other interesting details the movie has. When they take the beach and we see Mellish crying, and it cuts to Hanks and his hand is shaking, I point out to you that maybe that's early onset Parkinson's.
Yeah, it's weird. I think the suggestion is supposed to be that it's him cracking up. He has this cool exterior, but he has his own crime scene later when mm-hmm. they take out the sniper's nest.
Yeah.
Because they never really explain what's making his hand shake, so it's probably just meant to be like, under his cool exterior is a man who's suffering just like the rest
There's
of them.
There's PTSD that's happening during the war still. It also connects him with the big baddie, Hitler, who also people say had Parkinson's. The very few videos you can find of him. There's one in particular where they show him giving out medals to the German youth, what they call them, the Hitler Youth. And he has a hand shaking as he tries to hide it behind his back.
Yeah, I didn't know that till you told me that.
But after that, it's quite a sight. Yes, it is. As Horvath, the Tom Sizemore character, is putting dirt samples into that sack. That was based on something people really did. When we took North Africa, when we took this other place, now we've taken the beach of Normandy. It must suck carrying around that whole satchel of dirt, though. And I've read that that doesn't even happen anymore because they don't want soldiers bringing back cultures that may actually be a problem. Maybe diseases, invasive species in that dirt. So it's a bad idea.
So the other thing they do when they get up there is now that they have the German soldiers at their mercy, the German soldiers have just shredded them to ribbons, killed an unbelievable number of American soldiers. The Americans turn around and act just as viciously as the German soldiers did. Actually, more so because these men are surrendering to them and they're killing them anyways and laughing about it.
I was reading online that that's Czech guys who are enlisted against their will.
Oh.
And what they're saying in their language is, I'm not fighting, I'm not trying to fight, please don't shoot me. And then bang, dead you are.
One thing that this movie, even though it has that really patriotic open and close, the soldiers do not behave patriotically. They don't talk about the homeland. They don't talk about the glory of their nation, about America. You get patriotism from the general who's quoting Lincoln and has this honorable mission that is really symbolic. But the soldiers on the ground, they care about themselves. They care about their men. They care about going home to their home, but not like home to America.
They care about the mission and the men.
And that seems true for the German soldiers as well. I really do like the way that he chose to portray the enemy soldiers, because he shows both sides doing the same behaviors. You know, the Germans are callous, but the Americans are callous. The Americans are afraid, well, the Germans are afraid too. You see them just be people, be humans, and really persistent with the language barrier as well. They're just yelling at them in German, which is, you know, exactly what I would do if an enemy soldier came and had me in my foxhole. I would just yell at them in English, whether they could understand me or not, because you're just so desperate to communicate with them.
Well, speaking of German soldiers, the guy who plays Steamboat Willie, that's what his name is in the credits, the one that I think they probably should have just executed, but then up him with his morality, and I don't really agree with his morality. Jeremy Davies, the whole thing, he's a good part of this movie, he's a good actor. This is wrong, sir. You can't just execute him. And it looks like Miller's really going to do it. And then he has his big speech, which apparently Hank said to Spielberg, this guy wouldn't say this much about himself. He still says quite a bit. He reveals quite a bit about himself being a school teacher back home. And people believe that. That's who I am kind of thing. I just want to get back to be with my wife again. They let that guy walk away. And that's when Ryben wants to get out of that. He doesn't want anything more to do with that mission. But that guy gets back in the war. He's supposed to give himself up. And of course he doesn't. There's a dispute online about whether or not he's the guy that kills Mellish with the knife and the Listen. One of the great death scenes in any movie, because Adam Goldberg sells it so well. First he manages to keep him from doing it, and it's his knife, by the way. He pulls the knife out and gets taken away from him, but then when he dies, it's that.
But is it the knife he gets at the beginning that they pulled from one of the soldiers, and it was a Hitler Youth knife?
Yeah.
So it's his knife that he stole from a German soldier that is then used to kill
him. Oh, I never thought about that. Mm-hmm. You're right. How about that? It comes around even more. Okay, you're right. And they also set it up that Upham is going to get up there and save him at the last second, but he chickens out. Roger Ebert pointed this out in his review. The Upham character is what most of us probably would be in war. We're not going to be the Tom Sizemore, I just got the wind knocked out of me after I got shot five times, I'll be okay, and then just die. It's going to be the guy who's terrified and doesn't save his buddy when he hears him struggling with a German soldier. All he has to do is walk up there, pull out whatever gun he's got, and that German soldier is dead. But anyway, the controversy is that Steamboat Willie, the one that was set free earlier, people say it's not, but Steamboat Willie is definitely the guy who shoots Hanks, as far as I'm concerned, at the very end of the film.
Yeah, I think as far as everyone's concerned, he's the one that pulls the trigger on.
And somehow Upham seems to know that. Or maybe just the fact he recognizes him as being back in the military. You were supposed to surrender, and I saved your life so you could surrender and not die, and you didn't do that, so bang, you're dead. The one and only time Upham will probably ever kill anybody.
Unless this is the turning point for him, and now he's okay with killing.
And he becomes Charles Manson.
Well, he didn't kill, and then his friends got killed as a result, which makes him second guess whatever was in his head that made him rescue Steamboat Willie, that part of himself died when he saw his buddies die. So the next time he comes across Steamboat Willie, he doesn't care anymore. He killed him because he never gave himself in like he was supposed to. Maybe he saw that he shot Captain Miller. Maybe he just wanted to intimidate the rest of the soldiers, and he's such a wuss that he knew they would probably spot his vulnerability unless he's terrified them. So it could have been that.
Good angle. I never thought of that before.
But he became a soldier in that moment, and he learned to kill, and you know that that's going to change him and ruin him as a person. He's a good person. He's a sweet guy. He's gentle. He's vulnerable. I would also be Upham. I would be a destroyed person if I was forced to kill somebody or even just be around that much carnage and death. I could never cope with it.
And he's one of only two people from the original group that survives. He and Ryan are the only ones to do, along with Ryan, but he's not part of the original group.
You either have to be a deserter or coward to survive in that company.
Or you can be an idiot like Vin Diesel's character. Captain, the decent thing to do would be take her to the next town and keep them safe. But they're not here to do the decent thing. They're here to follow fucking orders. One of the rare times Tom Hanks has ever sworn I can recall in that movie. And this movie does have an awful lot of swearing in it. And it's one of the reasons why there's all these controversies online as well. I can read all about this on Wikipedia and the IMDb. TV stations didn't want to show this movie uncut because of the language and the violence. I remember when I heard that, I thought, there's swearing in this film. And then when I saw it again, I thought, oh, yeah, there's plenty of fucks, actually.
How anybody could be offended by an F-bomb when they've just sat through the grotesque violence of the first 30 minutes of that film.
And if you're to believe the people that saw the movie that experienced this, it's educational. And if it's educational, then let's just show things as they are. It's stupid to pretend that the soldiers would have been saying, oh, gosh, ooh, they wouldn't have had the constipation death we saw in so many film noir movies in the 30s and 40s. And so many other war films, actually, where it's the shot in the arm or the shot in the gut. Oh, that hurts a bit. I'm dead. It's the, mama, mama, oh my god, my guts are falling out of me, literally on the ground.
And even one of the characters that we learn to know and love, the medic, Wade, he's crying out for his mother as he's dying. Although, I shouldn't say I knew and loved him, because I actually found him fucking insufferable.
Giovanni Ribisi is never one of my favorite actors either. People love that guy, or at least they did back in this era, because he'd been on Friends and he did other things, and people thought he'd become a big star. But he was a weird actor and annoying in almost everything he did, to a point. I thought he was fine in this movie. I thought he was better than you thought he was. But he is kind of annoying. He has that speech in the church about how, I didn't wake up and see my mom. And then, of course, he's next to die. And I've always pointed out to people who love this movie, did you notice the sequence before they try to take that tower, which is a dumb mission? Hank says something and they cut to Ryben saying, I don't know, I have a bad feeling about this mission, sir. And who's squatting right beside him at that point? Wade, the one who doesn't make it out of that scene. So deliberate foreshadowing by Spielberg. But I mentioned a minute ago Vin Diesel, who was certainly a nobody at this point. And it took a little while for him to become that big star he's become with the Fast and Furious movies. His character is a lunkhead. He seems like a good soldier. The whole thing was trying to help the girl out, which is a decent thing, I guess. But she also wants to stay with her fucking family up in that bombed out house. Then he gets shot by the sniper and, my letter's got blood on it. He seems like he's an idiot.
Yeah, the letter as a plot device. There's a few kind of steady plot devices that carry throughout the film. The FUBAR thing with Upham. The letter that people keep taking turns carrying around because they keep dying. The captain's origin story. Those were things that ruined the authenticity of it. And when you have something as authentic as the Normandy invasion scene, those things really do wind up standing out. Like the captain's origin story, for instance, where they all have the pool. I believe that. I actually find it kind of cute, believable detail that he would keep his life back home a secret. It works with the theme that war changed him so significantly. But then there's that moment when they're in the French town with Paul Giamatti's character, and they're under fire. They're on a mission, and Upham, the coward, he would be curious, but he's such a coward. It's ridiculous to believe that he would be pressing all the men for details while they're trying to get around this sniper obstacle in that French village. He should be terrified of thinking about anything but winning the pool on finding out where the captain's
and
from.
And seconds before, he's hugging Tom Sizemore. Keep me safe.
Is phony. It just doesn't work. This is where I'm like, Spielberg, I know you know better. he's such a genius, but then sometimes he's a lunkhead. Sometimes Spielberg is the
sometimes
lunkhead.
Sometimes he's the Vin Diesel.
Yeah.
Well, that whole sequence plays out in rain, and these guys must have spent half the shoot completely drenched by rain towers, because that's a long sequence, actually, and they're also dirty, and then, of course, they're in the water in the beginning of the sequence. A lot of them end up in the water, at least. They must have been extremely uncomfortable in the shoot, which is why you get Dale Dye to take you out there and say, this is what it was like to be a soldier, or at least a small version of that, because this shoot is going to be harder than you even think.
And making your actors uncomfortable and miserable is probably part of getting a believable performance while they're playing characters that are supposed to be uncomfortable and miserable.
A few more things about the ending, where you've got the A-team set up. They're MacGyvering their way through it with what little ordnance and firepower they have to fight off the Germans. Although they are pretty smart about how they do fight back and do as much damage as they do. But then the Deus Ex Machina build up to the ending with the planes that come out. Where were those fucking planes 2 minutes before?
Yeah, it's a little disappointing. Like, it feels a little anticlimactic, although I guess it's better than doing the predictable ending where at the very last minute somebody blows up the bridge.
Which is what Hanks is trying to do when he goes out there to get the detonator, but then Steamboat Willie blasts his chest out. All right, the cast, it's dudes, dudes, and more dudes. It's white, white, and more white. Hanks has had 3 FI films he's done now. They're all compressed in a short period of time because he was in Forrest Gump, Toy Story, now Saving Private Ryan. He was a private in Forrest Gump. Now he's got to save a private. His second-in-command, Tom Sizemore, had been in lots of movies before this. I really like his tiny role, uncredited, in fact, in Heat. Not Heat. In Point Break. And then he'd been in Heat a couple years before this, where he's De Niro's subordinate, or second-in-command, whatever you want to call it. He was going through a bad drug addiction before this shoot, and Spielberg said to him, you're going to do a drug test every day on set. If you fail, you're fired. And if we get way into the movie, we're going to reshoot.
Yeah, it's a shame that his career kind of fell apart, probably because of his problems with addiction, and now he's a bit of a joke, and he's kind of known for appearing repeatedly on Celebrity Rehab. And it's a shame because he's a really talented actor, and you really see it in this film. He's incredible.
Michael Madsen could have had the role, and Billy Bob Thornton was also in line for it. They would have been pretty good, but I like the physicality Sizemore brings. He's so brawny and big. And let's see where he says, you two guys on my ass! You can picture, yeah, I'm going to follow the big dude. I've always said, if you're going to follow somebody into war, Tom Hanks, yeah, if I had to go follow anybody and die in war, I'd follow him. I'd never follow the Orlando Bloom character in Kingdom of Heaven. I wouldn't follow that fucking guy in the toilet. And Sizemore, I would also follow into war if I had to follow anybody. Yep, I'll get on your ass. I'll trust you. Barry Pepper, the sharpshooter. So many good movies for this guy. He had that interesting role in True Grit a couple years ago. And then another role in a Tom Hanks movie the year after this, The Green Mile.
Garth Brooks could have had the part. Frank Darabont did some uncredited rewrites, and he created the role of Jackson with Garth Brooks in mind. I think it's easy to forget what a phenomenally huge star Garth Brooks was in the 90s. So he was going to play it until he found out that Spielberg and Hanks got attached. He didn't want to play second fiddle to Hanks. I don't know what kind of movie he thought it was going to be. So Spielberg still offered him any other part he wanted, and he wanted to play the bad guy. And Spielberg's like, there's no bad guy in this movie. And he's like, fine, I don't want to be in it anyway. And he decided not to, which is probably for the better.
As you're saying that, I was picturing Dwight Yoakam, and I was about to pipe up and say, he was a great villain in Panic Room a few years after this film.
Oh, Dwight Yoakam is a good actor.
He's a damn good actor. He's terrifying in Panic Room.
Also terrifying in Sling Blade. He brought up Billy Bob Thornton.
Right, yeah, a couple years before this movie. So back to the group again. Edward Burns, probably known more for directing and acting in his own small New York films, and I've not liked him in a lot of things. When I saw Brothers McMullen again a second time a few years ago, I didn't like it nearly as much as I did the first time. But I liked him a lot in this movie, and when he does want to desert, as wrong as he may have been, I can understand why he wanted to leave.
His turnaround in the end is a little silly.
Well, he has that moment that I know you didn't like, where he eyes Private Ryan, and they look at each other, nod, and, you're okay after all, kid.
It's just pulling your punches. I find the tone and the themes just not consistent enough to really come together in the end for the viewer to have this overall understanding of what he's trying to put forth. You talked about Apocalypse Now. Apocalypse Now, it's a crazy film that drives the audience crazy, and it accomplishes this without letting the audience see the mechanisms, and that's the genius of it. A great example, I can't believe we haven't brought this up yet, but All Quiet on the Western Front. It's a film that was made in the 30s, and it's far more transparent about its themes. It's a very strong anti-war message.
From the German point of view, and World War I.
Yeah, that's right. Scenes that were, at the time, pretty violent and shocking, and definitely the portrayal of soldiers on both sides having the same reactions and humanity about them. Those themes are cohesive and you really understand when you leave the film what he's trying to say. With Saving Private Ryan, I felt confused. You hate war, but war is right. You are making a sentimental, sappy film. You're making a gritty, realistic film. Doesn't come together for me.
All right, you were just hacking on Spielberg, your longtime foe. So here's his final AFI film. He's had six, and we've already mentioned the six of them. The screenplay was by Robert Rodat, who went on to write The Patriot, another big war film for Mel Gibson, and Thor 2. And you mentioned Frank Darabont did an uncredited rewrite. He's done that on plenty of movies. And Scott Frank also had a hand in rewriting this one. He had written Out of Sight a few years before, and I think he also wrote Get Shorty. Oh, for that matter, Minority Report for Spielberg in 2002. And the four producers were Spielberg himself, Ian Bryce, who went on to do the Transformers movies, and Bryan Cranston's character is Colonel Bryce, probably an homage to the producer. Mark Gordon, who just recently produced Steve Jobs, the unfortunate failure that's still in theaters now, and Gary Levinsund. Now that we're ending Spielberg movies, you're not his biggest fan. He's one of my favorite directors. This movie was what you thought it was going to be. You didn't think you were going to like it, although you'd seen it before, so it just played out like you thought it would when you watched it all over again. But you were impressed with E.T. more than you thought you would be. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite of his six movies, and what's your least favorite of his six AFI movies?
Well, I think Schindler's List is hands down his best film. Which one am I most likely to pop in and watch any given night? It would be either Jaws or E.T. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of them are just varying degrees of respect. I respect those movies. I respect Spielberg as a director, but it's just not my jam. Like, it's just not my style of movie. I'm not super into adventure films. Saving Private Ryan, it's not really an adventure film, but its flaws are just things that I struggle with.
All right, so the 185:1 Blu-ray that we watched looks as good as it's ever going to. It's supposed to look washed out, desaturated, and imperfect. The cinematographer, Janusz Kaminski, who did shoot Schindler's List for Spielberg and pretty much everything he's done since. In fact, I think he shot everything, including that fourth Indiana Jones movie after Douglas Slocum had done the first three, but Slocum had died. So unlike All Quiet on the Western Front and other war films we've covered way back when, this is not actually black and white, but a good deal of color was sapped out in post digitally. And then the story goes that some of the TV stations that bought this to air on their networks would put color back in because audiences complained and said, why does it look so bad? Had you not heard about this blockbuster from 1998, you fucking morons? The movie was shot that way on purpose. I guess people don't follow that stuff the way we do. Michael Kahn was Spielberg's editor again. He's done every Spielberg movie except Jaws and E.T. on this list and everything that Spielberg's made, I think it was since Close Encounters. Oh, he didn't cut E.T. because he was working on Poltergeist for Spielberg instead. John Williams, you mentioned him already, his seventh and final AFI film. We've covered him so much the last few months. He did all six of the Spielbergs and Star Wars. I know he didn't like the score, you said that already, so we won't even bother commenting on that. The influence, you mentioned All Quiet on the Western Front already, and I mentioned Braveheart. And then that's one of the biggest influences of Saving Private Ryan, the excessive blood and guts in war films. They weren't pushing out anymore, they were saying, let's show what war really is. Nobody really got it as much as Saving Private Ryan did, but at least they're influenced in, okay, maybe not a good way, but an appropriate way, the accurate way.
Not just in films, but in TV shows and video games.
Oh yeah, Call of Duty, I guess, is one of those. I don't know anything about video games. I never play them, but I've heard that one is very graphic.
And very Saving Private Ryan inspired.
Yeah, when you think about something like The Walking Dead, a TV show, kids could watch that. It has nothing to do with Saving Private Ryan, but my God, you get people's, well, they're not really people, they're former people, just splattered and blasted every which way with arrows and guns and axes and knives. Maybe this movie had something to do with that.
And I kind of have to agree with the censors that when it comes to war violence, I'm way more forgiving than if it's gang violence or something else. Even zombie violence, monster violence. I feel like people should see the results of war.
Or the exploitative horror films, which are just trying to capitalize on that. And the Saw films have been entertaining, and some of the other blood and guts movies of the last 10 or 15 years. But they maybe haven't earned it, I guess you could say, like this movie does. Last influence I want to mention is Band of Brothers, the TV series that Spielberg and Hanks produced. They won some awards for that. People liked it. I saw it. Thought it was pretty good. It took a while to really get where it wanted to be because they have so much of the boot camp stuff before they actually drop in. But it's the Airborne guys. It's the Matt Damon people that we're following. All right, Private Ryan's awards. 5 Oscars for Best Director. Spielberg's second after he won for Schindler's List. The editing by Michael Kahn. The cinematography by Kaminski. The sound and the sound effects. The 6 failed noms, and this one was very controversial. Best Picture. When Harrison Ford came out, my friend and I saw the Oscars back in those days, and we looked at each other and said, well, Private Ryan's going to win, and Harrison Ford must be thinking, I'm giving this to my friend. Instead, he opens up the envelope and says, Shakespeare in Love, in his Harrison Ford monotone.
I loved Shakespeare in Love. I love wordy, beautifully written scripts like that, and I was a big Tom Stoppard fan when that movie came out, and I think I probably had a crush on Joseph Fiennes, too. So I was thrilled.
A lot of people were. No one looks at that and says it was a terrible choice. Well, okay, some people obviously
think it's a terrible choice. Yes, some people definitely say it's a terrible choice.
And some would say it's the biggest miscarriage of justice, but it's not the biggest miscarriage of justice at all. At least Private Ryan got nominated because some of the great movies didn't even get as far as the Best Picture nomination.
I think we all know that Crash is the biggest miscarriage of justice in the Oscars.
Over some better movies like Brokeback Mountain, which we covered on the Not 100 Project, and Good Night and Good Luck, and a few other good movies in 2005 as well. So carrying on with the six failed nominations, Best Actor for Hanks. That was a good group of guys. Roberto Bernini won for Life is Beautiful. But I always thought Ian McKellen was the best thing in that group. And Hanks himself, who'd won twice before, he wasn't winning again a couple years later. In fact, Hanks' best performance was actually Castaway. Yes. And he wasn't going to win a third time in about 6 or 7 years. Rodat's screenplay was nominated. The sets, the makeup, that would have been a very good choice, an appropriate choice. Because, as you said, an awful lot of amputees were made up. And then you explode off the fake body part, the arm, the leg, the whatever. And it looks like you're actually hurting these poor actors. And then Williams' music, and I know you don't like that choice, and I don't really either. It's not one of his best. The movie made the National Film Registry just last year in 2014. That's the same year as The Big Lebowski and Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Neither AFI movies, but then no other AFI movies did make it in 2014. Those are just very popular titles I wanted to mention. The other AFI recognitions, 45th on the Top 100 Thrills, 10th on the Top 100 Cheers. I think Spielberg had three top 10s because he had E.T. and I think he had Schindler's List.
Cheers. Oh my God.
And then Wonderful Life was number one on that list. Private Ryan was 8th in the epic category of the Top 100 Genre. So he had two of those epics because Schindler's List was also in there. And the two failed nominations for AFI lists, Top 100 Quotes with Earn This, Earn It, and Captain Miller as a Top 50 Hero. Okay, well, I guess we've kind of already summarized our thoughts about this movie. Actually, you know what? I'm going to say this right now. It was my favorite movie in 98. It's always been the first movie I put in a DVD player or now a Blu-ray player. I don't know why. It was just the first one I ever put on my very first DVD player, and it's been my tradition to test the thing, partly for the sound effects in that yes. opening battle scene on Omaha Beach. But watching it through the eyes of 121 now AFI movies with only two left to go, and other great war films, other Spielberg films, I like it more than you did. I know it belongs on this list for all the reasons that movies make this list. The influence, the success, the money it made, popularity over time. And people still love this movie. One bad influence, by the way. I mentioned that Oliver Stone criticized this movie. Well, George W. Bush says this is his favorite film of all time.
Yeah, I can't believe that this movie would help recruitment. People criticized it for glorifying war. But you do because you have Captain Miller, who's such a valiant hero.
Are you really surprised that George Bush doesn't get it?
Good point.
So it belongs on the list, but I didn't like it as much this time. And when I watched Pleasantville, also from 1998, one of my favorite movies of that same year, I felt that held up pretty well. I haven't seen Shakespeare in Love in a long time, so it's still my favorite movie of that year, but it isn't quite as effective for the reasons you said. I'm not in your camp, but I understand why your camp is your camp.
Yeah. All right.
Your last thoughts.
I can't argue with it being on the list, even if it's just for that scene of the invasion in Normandy. It's so good that it's probably worth honoring as one of the best films. God damn it, I really struggle with this one. I don't know what to say.
Well, would you say what I said about Titanic, that when it's got all those credentials, that even if we think the movie's got a terrible screenplay and some stupid dialogue, how does it not make the AFI list?
And you got to give it up for popularity, although if you use that argument, then, you know, Twilight would be in the top 100 list.
No, but that's not all we ever do. We do bring it down to influence, and we bring it to the things I just said a minute ago.
And I have to acknowledge that I'm not the target audience for war films, so maybe I'm not the best judge.
We mentioned All Quiet on the Western Front, made the first list, knocked out the second list. This one, of course, couldn't have made the first list. They're probably not connected.
Oh, but one replaces the other. Yeah, I bet you're right.
Okay, that's it for Saving Private Ryan. Up next on the Top 100 Project is our penultimate AFI movie and our final horror picture, The Sixth Sense. AFI film, huh? Okay, I won't editorialize yet. The coming attractions trivia for The Sixth Sense. How many of the 13 AFI movies during the 1990s killed off its main character?
Oh, that's a good question. Okay, so for the answer to that, please tune in to next week's podcast. If you'd like more trivia from Ryan and me, along with all kinds of other fun stuff, including links to some of the things that we talked about in today's podcast, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, rate us, review us. It helps people find us, and we love that. You can find Ryan and me both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51 if you would prefer to message us privately. We'd love to hear from you guys. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And before we go, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, sparkplugcoffee.com.
Upham, you listening?
Yeah.
Fucked up beyond all recognition.
Oh, now I get it.
God, you're stupid,
Upham. And cut.